I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. In this hour, it's Midday on Midlife. Midlife can be a dizzying hash of juggling jobs, keeping a marriage vibrant, tending to children as they enter adulthood, and caring for parents as they enter their twilight years. No wonder the term midlife so often has the word crisis attached to it. But our 40s, 50s, and 60s can also be a time when we come into our own, forge new relationships, and discover fresh things about the world and ourselves. In this archive edition of Midday, former NPR correspondent Barbara Bradley Haggerty takes a clear-eyed look at the challenges and joys of being old enough to know better and young enough to enjoy new things. We can't take your calls during this rebroadcast. Barb Haggerty on Life Reimagined, coming up right after the news. Music by Paul McCartney, age 74. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us today. A conversation on Midday about midlife. Barbara Bradley Haggerty is a former correspondent with NPR. She's written a terrific book about the vagaries of midlife, roughly defined as being between the ages of 40 and 65. On the one hand, she describes it as pushing a wheelbarrow full of dense, unfilled ambition up a steep gravel path. On the other hand, in this very smart and engaging survey of the research about this famously unresearched stage of life, younger people and older people get a lot more attention, Haggerty suggests a myriad of ways that people who are older but not elderly can embrace life's fullness in ways that were impossible when they were in their 20s and 30s. One researcher suggests that as many as 80% of men experience what's come to be understood as a midlife crisis. Another says that about 1 in 10 people in general will have that experience. One of the many scientists that Haggerty quotes is a renowned scientist named Viktor Frankl, who observed that life is never made unbearable by circumstances, only by lack of meaning and purpose. So where do we find that meaning and purpose? In our marriage, in our work, through our kids? How important are friends? And what if some of our friendships fall by the wayside as we get older? And does having a sense of purpose automatically lead to happiness? Well, this is a great read, regardless of whether or not you are pre, current, or post-midlife. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. It's just out in paperback, and Barbara Bradley Haggerty joins me in the studio. Barbara, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's establish one thing from the top. I'm 62 years old. How old are you?
I'm 57.
All right, so we're a little bit older, but in that same cohort. And obviously, our understanding of this phenomenon known as midlife would be different if we were 40 or 80. So we've got that established. I remember I was walking my dog, a brand new dog. I went to the SPCA, and I got this little beagle to replace the other beagle that had died 4 years earlier. And this was a few years ago, like 5 years ago. And I run into this guy, and he's walking his dog. And he says, "Who's your dog?" And I say, "Oh, I literally picked her up from the SPCA 20 minutes ago." And he says, "Don't you know that life begins when the dog dies and the kids leave home?" And that sounded like some famous, you know, aphorism. And I hadn't known that. And I'm delighted, first of all, to read in your book that the dog does not have to die. Yeah, because you have a lovely chapter about things that you have done with your dog. But the kids have, in fact, left home. I only have one, and she's long gone. But it's interesting. Midlife is one of those words, as you mentioned in the book, that has the word crisis attached to it an awful lot of time.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, people think that, I mean, it's one of these cultural phenomenons, right? Midlife crisis. It's really the natural outflow of the word midlife. But, you know, it's interesting, Tom, because there was for a long time this thinking that, as you quoted, 80% of people have men have midlife crises. And this came from the research of a man named Daniel Levinson at Yale University. And he interviewed 40 men, and decided at the end of all of these interviews that actually 80% of men have midlife crises. And then Gail Sheehy wrote the book Passages, and suddenly a cultural phenomenon was born, right? The problem was that psychologists then decided they had to kind of see if this was actually true. And so they began interviewing hundreds of people in the 90s and early noughts, and found that, in fact, midlife crisis is neither common nor inevitable. What they found was that most people do kind of experience an ennui during midlife, a malaise during midlife, especially in your 40s. The low point is 45. But only about 10% of people actually have a midlife crisis, this kind of existential angst that you're going to die before you can accomplish all your dreams, and therefore you have to buy a red sports car, right, and trade in your spouse for a newer model. So so that is actually a myth that's driven America for a long time.
And it's not just relegated to men. I mean, you yourself assumed you were having one, which in part was the animating force behind writing this book.
Right, right. If I can just tell you that anecdote about what happened. My very closest friend is my mother. And when she was 59 and I was 51, she had a stroke, and we weren't sure that she
was
would...
59 and you were 51.
I'm sorry.
That doesn't work.
No, I'm sorry.
That's
she was 89.
Yeah, there you go.
Forgive me.
There
she was 80. Yeah, that would have been like the virgin birth or something. Or even more dramatic. No, she was 89, and I was 51, and she had a stroke. We weren't sure that she would ever regain consciousness. We weren't sure she would ever talk again, nothing like that. And this was just tragic for me because I so adored her. And I remember coming home from the ICU after a few days there, staying there all day long. And it was right before Memorial Day, which is such a beautiful time of year in Washington. And I was looking...
Yeah, cherry blossom
cherry
right
blossoms,
before that, sure.
And,
yeah.
You know, the grass and the trees were that wonderful shade of green, and everything was burgeoning, and the sun was shining. And I was making dinner with my husband, looking out at this beautiful scene in front of me. And I felt nothing. I just felt completely flat. And I looked at my husband and I said, "Devin, I think I'm having a midlife crisis." And he put down the tomato and he said, "Don't do that.
Please
don't have a midlife
Anything
crisis."
But that.
Right. And so that actually was the impetus. The next morning I got up early and I started my research, and I thought, you know, is there such a thing as a midlife crisis, or can we avoid it? How do you live a fulfilled life in the second half? And that was really the impetus.
At one point, you describe it as a combustible collection of small despairs waiting to ignite, unremitting dailiness of work, the minor but scary health issues, the unpalatable fear that this is as good as it gets. Anybody over the age of 50, at least, is going to relate to that.
They will. I mean, something really happens in your kind of mid-40s and getting into your 50s, where life just feels, I think, a little bit harder, a little bit flatter. And I think the reason is, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. One is that you don't have the energy that you had in your 20s, for example. I don't enjoy pulling all-nighters as much as I used to. But also, you've got a lot of responsibilities in your 40s and 50s and 60s. You've got, you know, heavy responsibilities at work, and you've got maybe aging parents and kids and college tuition and mortgage payments. And so this is a burden time, in a sense, and people feel that. However, it's also a very meaningful time. And that's an important distinction that I found throughout all of my research, the distinction between kind of short-term happiness and long-term meaning. And midlife is full of long-term meaning.
You say one of the themes that you outlined early in the book is that it's best to choose purpose over happiness. That was fascinating to me. We all, you know, the Constitution says we have the right to the pursuit of happiness. Of course, Benjamin Franklin also famously said, "You have the right to pursue it, but it's up to you to get it." Yeah, but happiness versus purpose. What's that distinction?
Right, and actually, scientists have looked at this distinction as well. So when I say there are really kind of two ways to think of happiness. One is hedonia, which is your short-term happiness, having a great meal, a good beer, going dancing, whatever. And the other is eudaimonia. eudaimonia, which is kind of long-term. It's the Aristotle talked about it 2,000 years ago, this idea of the good life. The good life isn't an easy life or a fun life necessarily. The good life is filled with meaningful activities and striving toward a larger good. And so it can be things like raising great kids. That may not be happy in the moment, right? Or it could be, you know, pulling long hours at work for a larger purpose. There can be lots of things that are hard, but also meaningful. And what scientists have found in many, many ways is that hedonia, the short-term happiness, is great. I mean, everyone needs it from time to time, but it doesn't actually have long-term health benefits. Eudaimonia, this idea of purpose, striving, all of that for a larger purpose, that has huge health benefits. I mean, it was actually the big surprise of my research, how important purpose is.
And purpose is not something perhaps that we are keyed into when we're younger? I mean, are we more inclined to the hedonia, the hedonistic impulse to say, let's do this, it's going to feel good, you know, the Stephen Stills admonition to love the one you're with, that kind of thing?
That's right. I think, I mean, I think people are not as keyed into their purpose, although you do find a lot of young people, and I see it in millennials, trying to kind of strive for some larger purpose, say, in their work. Because, for example, the workforce is not quite as secure for them as it was when we got out of college. And so people have to really think about, you know, what's meaningful? What do I want to do for work? Put an emphasis on relationships because those are purposeful and meaningful. So but it's true that people are trying to divine their purpose as they go through their 20s and their 30s, and some lucky few people know it early on. But it is a long-term process where you're getting to know yourself. I mean, by your 40s and 50s, you have enough biography, you have enough kind of past history to know what you're good at, what you love doing, what you think are the larger objectives in life, and to know what you're not as good at. And so you can begin to kind of steer yourself to a more purposeful existence.
You talk about how the happiness curve of life is like a U.
Yes.
And that you're generally happy in your 20s, and then in your 40s, it starts going south.
That's right.
And that the sweet spot for happiness arrives in the late 60s.
Isn't that amazing?
So, you know, I'm looking forward to the next 5 years, I guess. But why is that? Because that actually didn't ring true to me, because my 20s were tough. My daughter's in her 20s now. I think 20s is really hard. I think that era between getting out of college and figuring out who you are is disconcerting and difficult.
That's really, really interesting. And I remember my 20s they're full of striving. I mean, I was a journalist right out of the box. And so I was very happy, but I was also striving hard. The way they get the statistic, though, is that economists have surveyed people in something like 80 different countries. And they ask a question: are you happy right now? Are you happy? And what they have found is that there is this U curve of happiness. And I think it has to do with burden, being having a lot of responsibilities. But people have fewer responsibilities in their 20s and 30s. In your 20s also, you have these aspirations that you think are within reach. You know, I could win an Oscar, or I could start a company, or, you know, find the cure for cancer, or be host of All Things Considered, right? Like, you have these aspirations. And then in your 30s, you're having kids probably. So, you know, you're getting a little more realistic. In your 40s, you're just kind of, you're getting through life. You're multitasking. You're doing the best you can. And what begins to happen in your 50s, especially your mid-50s, is some of those burdens are released. Your kids, you know, they're older. You're not paying for everything. Maybe you've paid off your mortgage. I don't know. But what begins to happen is not only do the burdens become less, but actually your brain changes. And this is some of the really cool research. It turns out that beginning in your kind of early 50s, your brain begins to focus on happier things and less, and does not focus on the negative things. And they find this to be increasing. This is an increasing phenomenon right into your 70s. So people in their 70s, you know, who may be on a walker or something, are happier than those of us at 45.
That's fascinating. And we should let folks know that this is a book about the science of studying, just like your religion book, which I also loved, which was The Science of Spirituality.
That's right.
This is the science, because you talk about people who pursue long-term meaning, this purposeful life, as they're protected at a cellular level.
It's
so this is a real thing happening inside your bod.
It's so cool. And if I can tell you, I don't know if we have time before the break, but let me just tell you about my favorite study. And this is done by Rush University Medical Center. And what these scientists have done is they have gone to retirement homes, people 60 and older, and they have given them a battery of psychological and cognitive tests every single year until the person dies. And then they're allowed to autopsy the brain. And they've been doing this for something like 20 years. And so what they have found, I love this, what they have found is that fully one-third of the people whose brains showed they had the plaques and tangles of Alzheimer's disease never showed a single symptom. A third of the people, they're called escapees, right? They escape. And so what the Rush University people can do is they can look back at the cognitive and psychological tests of these people over the years who escaped the symptoms of Alzheimer's and say, okay, what were the predictors? What were the things that these people did differently? And yes, they had a network of friends and family and they stayed cognitively sharp. But the primary thing, more than any other thing, the trait that meant that predicted that you would escape the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease was purpose in life. People who had a reason to get up in the get out of bed in the morning, those people were less than half as likely to experience the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease if they had it than people who had very little purpose. It doesn't have to be a huge thing. A little purpose is just fine, but you need to have something that you're excited about, and that will help protect you from the symptoms of dementia.
Well, I'm excited about having you here with me here in Studio A. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, her latest book is called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. We'll have more on midlife when we come back from a break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, is @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, another in a series of our segments considering the state of Baltimore 2 years after the uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray back in April of 2015. Tomorrow, we're going to talk with mentors and community activists Erica Alston Buck of the Kids Safe Zone and Sarah Heminger of THREAD. It's a mentoring program, so I hope you can join us tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Barbara Bradley Haggerty. In 2009, she published a wonderful survey about the science of spirituality called Fingerprints of God. And last year, she published another fascinating and fun book about midlife, which has just been released in paperback and which is the topic of our conversation this hour. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. You have an opportunity to speak with Barb Haggerty if you'd like. Our number here, 410-662-8780. You're welcome to give us a call. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. You talk, Barb, about a psychologist named Erik Erikson, pretty famous fellow, and you had some skepticism, at least initially, when you looked into this thing that he calls generativity. Mm. So as regards purpose, generativity is a sort of altruistic impulse. Right. What's that all about?
Yeah, so generativity is this idea that he considered it to be the hallmark of a healthy midlife. And it's this idea that as you get older and the kids begin to leave and you become more established, what you should do is shift away from investing in in yourself, essentially in your career or more, more cars and larger houses and all of that stuff. You should begin to shift to giving away, essentially, to investing outward. It could be outward into your community, a political cause or something like that. It can be into your kids, whatever it might be, but that there is this healthy shift away from yourself to the outward. And, I felt this was true. I have to say that as I went through my career, and I was married late. I was married when I was 43. And so my career really was the center of my life for a long time at NPR. But I began to feel this kind of disquiet that it wasn't all about me. And so even though I didn't have children, and even though in my 30s I wasn't married, I still began to kind of feel that I had to be kind of giving away a little bit more. And so when I began to look at the research, I did find that things like volunteering are hugely, hugely important to your life. I mean, they're actually really, really healthy. If you do 2 hours of volunteering a week, you are going to be in great shape, supposedly, according to the science. You'll be, you know, avoid stroke, and you'll have a much, much better life. The reason I was a little skeptical, if I can just say, is I tried volunteering with my dog, Sandra Day, Yellow Lab.
Wonder who she's named after.
Yeah. We got her. She's 14 years old. When we got her, she was we wanted a smart blonde, but Hillary was too divisive, so we went with Sandra Day. And so I would take Sandra Day down to GW Hospital every other Wednesday night, and we would meet with patients, and it did them a lot of good. But Sandra was fairly old by then, and she wasn't enjoying it, I realized, after about a half a year of this. And frankly, it was hard on her, and I began to kind of dread it because it was so hard on her. And I realized that not all volunteering is the same. And by that I mean that this was not my sweet spot of volunteering. It's a really wonderful thing to do, but it's not kind of what I do. I realized that that when you're in midlife, maybe what you should try to do is more like pro bono work. And by that I mean, try to use those skills that you've developed through all those years of work and all your passions and talents and all of that. Try to use those skills for the betterment of others. And so it's not just random volunteering. I think that's fine. But for me,
it's purposeful volunteering.
It's purposeful.
Taking what you're good at.
That's
and
right.
Sharing it.
That's right. And so that can be things like investing in young journalists. You know, mentoring people. It can be teaching classes at Georgetown. It can be at GW. It can, you know, take a variety of different forms. But it should be, in my opinion, it should be purposeful.
Talk about children. A lot of folks, I think, assume that the legacy they have in life, whatever that may be, is premised in their children. Children are obviously of great meaning to folks, but I know lots of people who chose not to have children who are perfectly happy and doing wonderful things. And it's interesting, you talk about volunteering, you talk about purposefulness, because all of those people I know are very engaged in their communities in so many different ways. But children, you find, are not necessarily a requisite for happiness, purpose, and meaning.
Yeah, that was one of the interesting things. It was one of the parts of the research that I was kind of dreading, because I don't have my own children. I have a wonderful 22-year-old stepdaughter who's just, I hit the jackpot with Vivian. But I was really happy to know that they weren't a necessary condition to having a purposeful life in midlife and beyond. You do, though, have to be more intentional. So children are kind of a natural way to be generative. You're investing in the next generation. It just happens naturally. If you don't have that, you need to think carefully. How can I invest in the next generation? How can I invest in a political cause? How can I help people in a way that I haven't had an outlet with a child? And so that's what I've tried to do. And you're right. The studies show that you do not need to have children to be happy in midlife and beyond.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty, the new book is called Life Reimagined, just out in paperback, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So children may not necessarily be required for happiness, but friends are.
Okay, I said purpose was a huge secret. This is the second big surprise for me, how important friends are. In fact, there's not a huge amount of studies on this, a number of studies on this, but those that there are very clear that friends are basically one of the best things you can do for midlife and beyond. And in fact, what's kind of tragic about that is when you enter midlife or in your 30s or 40s, you tend to drop your friends because you're focusing on your immediate family and on your career. But in fact, the studies show that friends are better for you health-wise than your family. maybe not your immediate family, but the thing about
friends.
You
can choose your friends. You can't choose your family.
That's exactly right. And that's what the studies show, that there is that you do very well if you have friends. You can't, you know, you recover better from more quickly from cancer. You are less likely to have a stroke or heart attack. There are just lots of studies that show that friendships are really, really important. And I don't know if I have time to tell this one study that I did when I went to UVA. I took a very close friend of mine to UVA, and we did this little study that was kind of moderated by Jim Cohn, who's a psychologist there. And basically what we did is he put me in a brain scanner. But before he put me in the brain scanner, he put an anklet on my ankle that would deliver electric shocks to me. And he said, oh, don't worry, it's just like a basic static shock. It'll just get your attention or whatever. So, you know, he puts me in the brain scanner. And then what I have to do is I have to look up at the screen, and if there is an X, I have a 20% chance of getting a shock in the next few seconds. And if there's a zero, I have 0% chance of getting a shock. And they wanted to test me in three different conditions. One, when I was just all alone, you know, kind of anticipating the threat of pain. What did my brain do when I was anticipating this threat of pain? The other condition was when I was holding a stranger's hand, i.e. one of the technicians. And the third was when I was holding Cherie Harder's hand, a friend who had been very close for 15 years or so. What they found with my brain and in one study after another is that what happens when you're anticipating, by the way, the shock, it's not like a static electric shock. It really, really hurt.
It hurt.
And so when you see that red X, you're going, wow, get me out of this brain scanner, right? Run, run, run. And the fear centers of your brain are just going nuts. And they're going nuts when you're alone and when you're holding a stranger's hand. But when I held Cherie's hand, the fear centers of my brain quieted. It's as if my brain was saying, yeah, you know what? This is going to be really painful, but don't worry. You know, Cherie's here. She'll help you get through it. That's what friends do. They help you get through the stresses of life. They help you navigate life. They give you perspective about family drama. They basically are your psychological, you know, companion that helps you get through things. Not only are they good for you psychologically, but they're actually good for you biologically. And so people with friends, you know, they repair skin more quickly. They're less likely to have heart attack or stroke. They keep their memories better. In fact, the worst thing you can do is be lonely. Being lonely is the equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So friends are really, really important.
That is really something. And I interviewed this guy one time. I read this wonderful book. He's from Hopkins here in Baltimore. His name is David Linden. He wrote a book called The Accidental Mind. He's an evolutionary biologist who studies the evolution of the brain. And he says that every culture on the planet, every single one, has three things in common, and only three things in common. There are other things that some cultures have that others don't, but there's always three things. One is a propensity for religious thought, some notion of God or some explanation that involves that. The other is music. There's no culture that doesn't have music. And the third is a proclivity or propensity for marriage. And we've sort of heard in the general, you know, zeitgeist that marriage is another predictor of happiness. But you're saying, for example, that friends even help marriages, that, you know, yes, marriages are better if you've got friends. So romantic love is, even though it's clearly a biological instinct we all have, is not necessarily the only thing.
Yeah, and that's really important for midlifers, because, in fact, there are more people who are either never married or divorced in midlife than any time in history. It's a really, really large segment. So it is good to know that we can actually have we can have all of these benefits by having friends and investing in them, even if you don't have, you know, an immediate family. And that's just wonderful news. And, you know, one of the other things that we found, Devin and I went, we rented an RV, right? And this is like, oh, this is a really bad idea. But we wanted to do something novel, because the research on midlife marriage is that you should incorporate some novelty in your marriage. So Devin had always wanted to rent an RV and kind of, you know, travel around. And I always thought that was a really bad idea. But I decided for the purposes of science, I would go ahead and allow us to rent an RV. And we brought two of our closest friends along with us, along with Sandra Day, the dog. And what we found is that the research is correct, that when you have friends around, it gives you an opportunity to do what you wouldn't do when you're just normally sitting around with your spouse. I could brag on Devin. I could talk about his achievements. He, you know, he didn't really like it because he's a modest guy, but it gave me great pleasure. I could look at him through the eyes of my friends and see what a really good navigator he was when it came to the RV and things like that. So friendships actually allow you to step back and look at your spouse in a way that is really approving and encouraging and fresh.
Kathy in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Barb Bradley Haggerty. And if our producer has summarized your thought correctly, you're going to ask the next question I was going to ask. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Yes, my question was, and I was thinking of it particularly in the first part of when you were talking, is during your research, did you find any differences with social or economic class? Do people respond differently as they go through middle age?
Yeah, you talk a little bit about men and women differences, and you know, but, right. But what about race, culture, and socioeconomic?
You know, what's really interesting is the U-curve of happiness is for everyone. So it really actually doesn't matter about, you know, whether you are highly educated. I mean, education tends to make people happier, but it doesn't matter if you're highly educated or wealthy or not, you still have that U-curve of happiness. The distinction, though, is that some people have people maybe who have less wealth and less education, their U tends to be lower. If you see, so the high is lower and the low is lower. That tends to be the case. However, there's an exception to the rule. And the exception to the rule is that people, less educated and less wealthy people who have a sense of purpose and meaning in their life, who score high on that, are just like college educated people. So they kind of leapfrog up there in terms of happiness. So the key is not so much externals like wealth or education. That those are helpful, for sure. But really the key is, do you have a sense of purpose and engagement with life?
And obviously there are certain stresses that come if you're worried about making the rent, and if you're worried about that next paycheck covering your expenses. But you actually talk to scientists who talk about stress as a good thing. There's a positive dimension to stress. That was surprising to me.
Yes. Yeah, I think that poverty is not a good kind of stress. What they were more referring to were the stresses, that acute stresses. So what I mean by that is if you have, not necessarily, but often it's, you know, have you had a real setback or, I mean, some awful things. Have you had a terrible accident that's made you disabled in some way, or have you, you know, your spouse died, or have you seen a terrorist attack, that kind of thing. And what they have found is that actually there's a sweet spot for stresses. So people who have no stress in their life, zero stressors, actually do worse than people who have 2 to 3 stressors in their life. And the reason is, and then people who have a lot of stress, that's a real problem as well. But the reason is that if you have some stress in your life, some setbacks, you can go along life and you can say, you know what? I've dealt with something like this before and I survived. It's called steeling or hardiness, that you develop a certain resilience and hardiness when you do have some stress in your life. And so we can use our past stresses to actually help us in the present.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's right,
I guess.
Exactly.
Or everything in moderation. Right? Just a little bit of stress. A teeny, teeny, teeny bit of stress. All right, Minna in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thank you for taking my call. I had not heard of this author or her books, and I'm sitting here in a retirement community here in Baltimore, and I'm laughing because I think the next book has got to be about those of us who are old. You've done the middle period, and now you've got to deal with old age.
That's right. You're next in line, Minna. That's good.
Actually, what has been said is, I think, very true. I mean, we had 4 children in 6 years, so that was certainly, we had to adapt, and we had to be mindful, and we had stress, all of those things. But we have 4 children and 10 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren and a new one on the way, and yet, living in a community where so much is done for us, that you still can find purpose in your life. And there are many people here, somebody who just died at 104. We just celebrated somebody's birthday at 102, another one who's 103. They have purpose in their lives, and you see it in their faces, in the sparkle in their eyes. When you talk with them, they may have a bit of memory issues, you know. But nonetheless, you can find purpose even living in a facility like this, where so much has been done for you, and I think purpose and hopefully optimism. There was a study that was printed in the New York Times not too long ago that people who are optimistic, there are things in your body that can be identified scientifically, that people who are optimists do better.
Yeah.
If your glass is half full.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Thank you, Minna, for that call. I really appreciate it.
And actually, Minna brings up a really, really good point, and that is that the purpose in life actually extends right into the end of your life. I mean, my mom is 95 and she's doing just great. And she has kind of a purpose in life. She loves reading the New York Times and the Washington Post every day and seeing my brother and me on a regular basis. And so she has a purpose in life. And what I should say is the studies show that as people age, they can find a purpose in things that give them great joy. So hobbies. I have one of the most exciting parts of this, for me, this journey, was finding that you don't have to have this kind of major purpose, but you can have a little purpose, hobbies that get you up in the morning, whether it's your grandchildren or playing chess.
We're talking about midlife here on Midday. The book is called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. The author is Barbara Bradley Haggerty, who will be talking about her book tomorrow night in an event sponsored by an organization called Well for the Journey. That event is at the Towson Unitarian Universalist Church. Starts at 7:30. We've got information on our website. If you'd like to join our conversation today, you are welcome to do that. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. Follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
The Beach Boys, when they say, wouldn't it be nice if we were older, they were probably talking about 24 instead of 22. Today we are talking about the joys and sorrows, the ups and downs of that time of life in which we're not young anymore, but we're also not old, particularly if you believe the suggestion that 60 is the new 40. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday in Barbara Bradley Haggerty's new book about midlife. She says that midlife is not fun, it's funny. So if you're anticipating midlife or in the middle of midlife or looking at midlife through a rearview mirror, give us a call and let us know what you think. 410-662-8780. That's our number, our email, midday at WIPR.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Let's go back to the phones. Michael in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Barb Haggerty.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had some follow-up questions about the study that the author cited that earlier in the conversation that she said was one of her favorites, and it involved people who, I think she said, had the plaques that indicated Alzheimer's disease, yet had none of the symptoms, and that whoever the researcher was had concluded that the reason that they were symptom-free was because they had some sort of purpose in life.
Yes. Michael, you know what? I was skeptical of that study until I went out there as well. I thought this is just way too good to be true, right? It was Rush University Medical Center, and they have a large in Chicago, and they have a large Alzheimer's area of study. And they've published something like over 30 articles in peer-reviewed journals, and I've read all of those articles. I've seen the autopsies. I spent time there at the laboratory where they were showing me the brain slices that they take of some of these participants and looked at them under the microscope. I feel really, really comfortable because their research is really widely respected. So what I'd suggest, I mean, don't take my word for it. Go ahead and look up Rush University, look up David Bennett, and you'll find a whole lot of studies that show this to be true, that purpose in life is really, really important.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Much appreciated. It's interesting that you talk about the physical problems that those of us of a certain age, encounter. I always joke with my wife that, if I wake up some morning and nothing aches, I'll know I'm dead. So I'm thankful for, the neck, the knee, the elbow. But you talk about how physical declines, this really fascinated me. Talk about skepticism. I'm a little skeptical of this. If physical declines are not related to aging, they're related to practice. Like I'm a runner.
Oh, I see.
And I run slower than I used to run. And I think it's because I'm not doing 8-minute miles anymore because I'm not 30 anymore.
Well, here's the point. I mean, I've got to tell you, I'm skeptical of that too. I mean, this is what the studies by a researcher, fairly famous researcher named Anders Ericsson in Florida. This is what he's found. He's found that deliberate practice, whether it's playing chess or the piano or running or whatever it is, that if you do deliberate practice, you should not see a decline in your performance. Okay, that's what he says. He's got a lot of studies saying that. I know my own body, and I know that
you're an athlete. You talk about the biking, the senior games as a cyclist.
That's right. And
you had a big crash on your bike.
Yeah, that was really fun. Broke my collarbone. But I think that you can do very well if you practice and if you're really, disciplined about it. But I too have some skepticism that you can perform. I have enormous skepticism that you can perform at an Olympic level or at your top level. Having said that, what I should say is that when I've been to the senior games, I've been now twice, once just as a reporter, another as a participant, and this is for athletes 50 and older. Some of those people were doing, especially in the swimming and a little bit in the running, some of those 50-somethings were doing college times in their swimming. I mean, really, like Division I college times.
Well, you have an athlete like Dara Torres who's, competed in the Olympics
exactly,
in her 40s.
Exactly. Yeah, right. But I don't think that's the norm.
Yeah. So maybe it's true for the two people that he
that's
knows.
That's right.
Yeah. He doesn't hang around at my gym, let me tell you. But you do mention that 70 million Americans, that's a lot of folks, suffer from chronic pain. Mm. And that is, something that generally accompanies aging, at least. And you talk about the research about what's referred to as mindfulness meditation.
Yeah.
But what surprised me, obviously meditating and calming down and, just centering yourself, what could be wrong with that? What's not to like? But you talk about how it's good for not only things like depression or sleep disorders, I can see that, but even things like weight loss.
Yeah, yeah.
How does that work?
So, and let me broaden it a little bit beyond just mindfulness. And this chronic pain thing is actually something that I experienced myself. It was actually one of the main reasons I left my wonderful job at NPR is because I had a partially paralyzed vocal cord and the chronic pain was just, it was pretty unbearable. And so I looked at this issue of chronic pain, and it brought me to things like mindfulness meditation, but also the placebo effect too, which is both of those are very important. What mindfulness does, well, let's talk about pain for a second. There are two types of pain. One is the pain that you feel when you put your hand on the stove. And that is telling you, get the hand off the stove. And that is very necessary. But then there's an emotional component of pain. If you feel a migraine coming on, oh my gosh, I'm getting a migraine. What am I going to do? Oh my goodness, me with my throat. Oh my gosh, my voice is going. What am I going to do? There's this emotional component. What mindfulness does is it actually strips away that emotional component. Once you get good at it, I'm not good at it, but once you get good at it, it strips that away, and and what people find is that their pain levels actually decrease. And it's also been found to be true with weight loss as well. I mean, it's most effective with pain, but it's found to be very effective in many other areas as well.
Memory. Here's another one.
What's that again?
And before I start calling you Doris, I want to ask you this, Barb Haggerty. You had another researcher say that age has nothing to do with memory, but effort does.
Yeah.
And you talk about, as others have, about the connection between physical activity and memory. And it's not necessarily, this thing of just, Sudoku puzzles or whatever, Sudoku, whatever that thing is called. So age and memory just, I mean, we all have our senior moments.
So, yes. And so I want to make 2 points. You know, one is about how midlife is actually a sweet spot for intelligence, okay? Because there are two types of intelligence. One is fluid intelligence, and that's the kind of Sherlock Holmes intelligence where you're able to solve problems, really novel problems, really fast, and you know, everything is firing quickly and all of that.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. And that goes downhill after around age 30, so that's the bad news. The good news is there's something called crystallized intelligence. And crystallized intelligence is all the stuff that you acquire over a lifetime. It's vocabulary, it's wisdom, it's, you know, expertise, it's all these other things. And that keeps going up and up and up right into your 70s. And so, for example, if you have a choice between a 35-year-old surgeon and a 55-year-old surgeon, pick the 55-year-old. He or she has been there before. He or she has seen, you know, when things go south on the operating table, he or she knows exactly what to do. Whereas the 35-year-old
might not. Practice makes perfect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So contrary to what many people think, that their minds are just going, you know, going downhill, there you actually get better and better, and you actually don't see really, really note. I mean, we all notice when we can't remember people's names, and so we think we all are, you know, a case of early onset Alzheimer's. But in fact, our intelligence is getting better and better right into our 40s and 50s and even into our 60s.
And when you talk about the difference between men and women, in terms of hetero marriages, I'm not quite sure how this works with same-sex marriages, but in hetero marriages, wives are the emotional centers, emotional historians, and the emotional thermostats of a marriage. I told this to my wife last night, and she said, yep, absolutely true.
Yes, and the researchers at Berkeley who did this study, they got a lot of pushback. They thought it sounded, you know, people thought it sounded very chauvinistic. But in fact, you know, that seems to be the case with Devin and me as well. You know, if I can stay calm, if I can just kind of ride out the storm, it's fine. He kind of comes back to center. And so the studies have shown that marriages where the wife is calmer or the emotional kind of centerpiece, those marriages do really well. You know what else is good for marriage? There hasn't been a lot of study of long-term marriage, but one of the studies has looked at long-term marriage for like 20 years. They've looked at the same couples over a 20-year period. And what they found is that the couples that stay together and are happy at the end of 20 years tend to be couples who use, get this, plural pronouns. So they use we and us as opposed to I and me. And what that suggests is it's not just a matter of syntax, right? It's a matter of, do you have shared goals? Are you in this thing together? Do you have someone in your corner? Is there someone who's, you know, who's going to fight for you? Is there someone who will help you through the emotional turmoil at work or whatever it is? Raising kids, all of that. So that is really, really important, to have a sense of we-ness, of us-ness in a marriage.
There's no I in team. That's right. we got like 40 seconds left, and I want to talk about encore careers. Mm. We saw President Obama, former President Obama, yesterday in Chicago making his first public appearance. He seems to be very publicly struggling with what he's going to do when he grows up, now that he's not the president. One of the things we know he's not going to do is spend his time bashing the current president. But encore careers are something that become much more common, and a lot of people are benefiting.
Yes, that's true. And what that means is that there are a lot of people who have maybe felt that their career is not as purposeful as they like. And so what you find are people are beginning kind of to shift their career. Think about, what can I do for the next 20 years that will really get me out of bed in the morning? And so increasingly, you're seeing people find a new avenue for their expertise and their talents. It may not pay as much, but it's really satisfying.
Well, we are delighted that one of your new careers is writing books, and this is a really fun one. So thank you so much, Barb Haggerty. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty, she's going to talk about her latest book, tomorrow night at the Towson Unitarian Universalist Church. That's on Delaney Valley Road in Lutherville. Her talk is sponsored by a group called Well for the Journey. It starts at 7:30. Her book was published in paperback last month. It's called Life Reimagined, The Science, Art, and Opportunity of Midlife. That's it for us today. Thursday marks the 2-year anniversary of the uprising that followed the death of Freddie Gray. So coming up tomorrow and Thursday, a conversation about what has changed and what remains to be changed since violence laid bare deep-seated wounds in communities of color in our city. We'll talk with community activists and legal experts about helping kids escape the clutches of poverty and changing the culture of policing in Baltimore. That's coming up on midday tomorrow and Thursday. I hope you can join us. Then before we go today, thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. Here and Now is up next after a break for the news at the top of the hour for the entire midday team. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.